Malcolm as he leads us on the subject, Ezekiel, national message.
Well, welcome to our second talk on the subject of Ezekiel. And the first time when we spoke to you last time on this topic, we pointed out that there are a number of very personal aspects to the message of Ezekiel. I think as a group we have a tendency to focus on some of the more involved visions that were in this prophet. And we don't realize that what was said to each of us, and is a really firm exhortation, was that Ezekiel was in a very difficult situation. He was asked to give a very unpopular message. He was away from his home circumstances, and yet God was with him. And in the first chapter of Ezekiel, that's the very firm message that we have, that despite the circumstances that he found himself in, God was there with him. And the personal exhortation for each one of us then is that God is there and can be there for us no matter where we are and whatever our circumstances. And we looked at a number of other sections that show the individual side of the message of Ezekiel, and then ended up in the 24th chapter. And there Ezekiel lost his wife. His wife died. And we're told that he spoke to the people in the morning. His wife died in the evening. The next day, he had to get up and give the same message. And the reason that he had to give that message that way, and he could take no time at all to mourn for the loss of someone who was very close to him, had been his companion for a number of years, and that's obviously the case when we look at the dates surrounding Ezekiel's message. That the reason that he had no time to mourn her death was that this was going to happen on a greater scale to the nation themselves. There would be a lot of people in that circumstance who would lose family members, who would lose everything that was important in their lives, and they would have no time to think, to recollect, to mourn, to feel sad, feel sorry for their situation. They were picked up and transported in many cases to Babylon. So now we're going to turn our attentions more to what was going on within the nation of Israel itself, the reason for Ezekiel's prophecy. For every one of the prophets came when they were needed. It's important then to recognize that the prophet, each one of them, had a very specific message. They came at a time when their message was required, was very important to the nation. And we should realize then that the things that went on in that nation are mirrored in the words of the prophets. And so I want to leave you with two thoughts today. And the first one is that the more things change, the more they stay the same. It's a little proverb, and we sometimes refer to it, although in our society we don't have these proverbs as much as my parents did. My grandmother, for instance, had a saying for almost every situation in life. But that's one that we hear every now and again. The more things change, the more they stay the same. And the next point that I want to leave you with out of today's talk is to just think for a moment about what was the function of a prophet. And then to extend that, and we'll get more to this point in the third talk in the series, as to how these things apply in our day and age. Now, before we actually look at Ezekiel, then, let's just think of what's going on today in our society. The Anglican Church is going through a severe split in this country. It's been precipitated by a number of decisions made by the church hierarchy. The one that makes the newspapers so often is this question of same-sex marriage. Now, more recently, when talking to the people in the parish out in Machosen, which is the one that's made the headlines recently, they say, no, it's not just that. There's an awful lot which is going on in the church which we cannot accept because we believe that the church is getting away from its biblical roots. There are a lot of things going on in our society, things which we as Christians must wonder about, and many of them we have to reject outright. Same-sex marriage is just one of those issues. There's the whole question of the rights of women and the role that women play in the churches nowadays, and many other social questions which are in our papers all the time. So why do I pick this up and point this out to you? Well, quite interestingly, in the first century church, about the second century, and these ideas were crystallized in the third century, we have an interesting little idea developed. It came about like this. They looked at the first chapter of Genesis and said, well, God made man in his own image. Male and female made he them, all in the same verse. And so the reasoning was then that God must have had both male and female attributes in order to make men and women in the image of God. So that then puts men and women on very different planes to the one that we see so frequently through Scripture. And out of ideas like that then have come all the questions which surround the function of women in the priesthood and so forth, which we have in our society today, which were very much a part of the church in the early years, second and third centuries particularly, until at the end of the fourth century, many of these ideas were discarded completely by the church fathers, and then the Roman church really took over with a very centralized system. Well, why bring points like this up? Well, as we said to you, the more things change, the more they stay the same. Now, in the Greek period, there were, of course, male and female gods and goddesses, and they had regular affairs, and this is all part of Greek mythology. In the Persian period, we don't find that so much. But when we get back to the time that we're talking about here in Ezekiel, the situation becomes once again transformed. The archaeologists have uncovered numerous clay figurines, and they're almost entirely of female forms. Incense altars, libation vessels, offering stands. And in fact, Kathleen Kenyon, when she was excavating in the area of the temple in Jerusalem in the 60s, came across a cache of more than 350 different female effigies. Now, the earlier original idea was that here we had a little shrine right up against the temple walls, that these little effigies indicated the way the Israelites were worshipping during the time of the kings, right up against the temple. And so the ideas which we have read today in the 8th chapter of Ezekiel came to mind and were talked about with that find. When you looked through the wall in the temple, what was going on right around and inside the temple at the time of the kings? Certainly there were clay figurines. Now, what were these figurines doing and what were they about? There's a Judean rock-cut tomb from the 7th and 8th centuries. And written on the wall is the one who was the originator, the original patriarch in that tomb. Blessed be Uriah by Yahweh. For from his foes, by Asherah, has he saved him. Now, who is Asherah? Well, Asherah was the female Canaanite god. And so you see what this man Uzziah had taken into his tomb and had written on the walls of his tomb. And that was interesting too, because we associate tomb paintings with the Egyptians. We don't associate it with the Jewish people in any form. And written right on the tomb was a blessing from Yahweh, and the idea that not only had Yahweh looked after this man in his life, but also the Canaanite female goddess had been looking after him throughout his life. And then surrounding through the period of the kings, we find a number of, they were really sort of overnight stops, sort of hotels, motels, we might call them nowadays, as you got closer to land of Judea. There were several of them around the borders. And all of these places were obviously used by merchants as they came. You remember it was in the Assyrian period that trade really became prevalent throughout the Middle East. The Assyrians thrived on trade the way our society does today. So you see another little point. The more things change, the more they stay the same. And within these little overnight stops, there were bowls for offerings. And in one of them, there's the name of the donor and the indication written around the rim of the bowl that offerings should be put in it for Yahweh. But then you just turn around and there are other bowls. There's a bowl that you can make an offering for Asherah. There's a bowl that you can make an offering for Baal. Another bowl where you can make an offering for the gods, the Assyrian gods that you had, where the area you had come from. In other words, we're getting ecumenical. And as you get into the land of Israel then, all of these different gods were welcome. And all of these different gods were acknowledged by people who traded back and forth around. You see, ideas were moving as well as trade goods. And ideas in that day and age also meant that religions were moving as well as trade goods. One of these really stirred a great deal of interest in the archaeological community when it was found, because it appeared that Yahweh and Asherah were side by side, with some form of, as we may say within Greek terminology, that there was an affair going on at that point. Jeremiah sums it up for us, and remember, Jeremiah was a contemporary of Ezekiel. Jeremiah summed it up for us with a little note that they had as many gods as there were towns in Judea at that time, and they had as many altars as there were streets in the towns. In other words, there was much outside the temple confines. And then there's the interesting little phrase towards the end of Jeremiah, who was the Queen of Heaven? And what were the cakes and what were the offerings that were being made, that were being baked by the women who made their offerings to the Queen of Heaven? Was it the Asherah that we've seen already? Was it the goddess of the Canaanites that we have already seen as being put, in some circumstances at any rate, side by side with the God of the Hebrews? There's a word which is used throughout the prophet Ezekiel. In the translation that I have, it's translated idols. There are 48 occurrences of this word in the Old Testament. 39 of them are in the prophet Ezekiel. My Hebrew translation pronunciation isn't very good, but it's gilulim is the way the word is given to us in our concordances. And originally what that word meant was some sort of spear. And the thought is that this was the sort of spears that the dung beetles formed and rolled along the ground. It seems to be that in its original usage, the word conveyed a little round lump of dung. Now, isn't it interesting that when Ezekiel spoke about idols, Ezekiel used a word whose root meaning was a little lump of dung. And it would be interesting, I think, sometime in Bible class to have a go at all of these different words that are translated that way in the Old Testament, because all of them, with just the one exception, have very derogatory interpretations within Hebrew. And even the one which is not so derogatory is certainly not a flattering term. The prophets and the way they spoke of these idols and these images which were prevalent throughout the nation of Israel during the time of the kings, the words that were used were very demeaning. Prophets thought of them as excrement. I want to look then firstly, before we go into Ezekiel, at a little section in 1 Kings. I'm going to look at a couple of verses from 1 Kings chapter 14. 1 Kings chapter 14, we're looking at the period when Rehoboam took over as king. Rehoboam, the son of Solomon, reigned in Judah. That's the 21st verse. 22nd verse, Judah did evil in the sight of the Lord, and they provoked him to jealousy with their sins, which they had committed above all that their fathers had done, for they built them high places and images. And that little word, images, is usually translated by the historians, and probably in many of your modern translations, as Asherah, as female goddess, forms of a goddess, Asherah. For they built them high places and images, high groves and in high hill and under every green tree. And in the next verse, in the 24th verse, most of the historians feel that that verse refers to male prostitution within the confines of the religion which was practiced in Israel under Rehoboam. Turn over to the next chapter, 1 Kings 15. In verse 11, Asa did that which was right in the eyes of the Lord, as did his father David. And he took away the Sodomites from out of the land, removed all the idols that his fathers had made. And also Maacah, his mother, even her he removed from being queen because she had made an idol in a grove. And Asa destroyed her idol. He destroyed her idol. That little word, her, is interesting. What does it indicate to us that it was her idol? Why was it hers? What function does that indicate that she had as queen relative to the worship of that idol? And most historians seem to feel that she was indeed some form of priestess in relation to the worship of this feminine, this goddess, this Asherah. Asa destroyed her idol, burnt it, but the high places he didn't remove. So, you see, as we said earlier, the more things change, the more they stay the same. Society doesn't change so much. The issues which are prevalent in our church today, of the role of women within the church, the actions that people carry out, the role of sex within our society, and so forth, they were all there when Ezekiel, they had been there for 400 years before Ezekiel spoke, and they were still there when Ezekiel took over his role as prophet to the nation of Israel. We could, but we won't take the time to do it. Work our way through Kings and get right up to the time of Ezekiel with similar phrases, and it's quite obvious that what we've got are is a continuation of a very mixed form of worship. And when the archaeologists tell us that there were all forms of religious, the religious, the bowls, the libation bowls, the small incense altars, the little statuettes and so on, everywhere throughout the land, it's quite obvious that the worship of the God of Israel was only a part of what was actually going on there. There's another point which has just skipped my mind. I had it in my mind a second ago, and I'm just trying to recall it, but I think we'll just move on, and maybe it'll come back. Anyway, so what we want to do now is go to the prophet Ezekiel and look at the message that Ezekiel delivered to this people. The other point which I was going to mention, Kathleen Kenyon's finding of about 350 female idols and against the wall of the temple, her original idea was that this was some sort of shrine, that they were there, and that this was a place where people went to worship and went to deposit their little effigies and with the wishes that go along with them, probably for the birth of a child or something like that. But the other idea, which seems to be taking hold in the among historians and archaeologists, is that probably this was the work of someone like Josiah, that just took all these images, dug a hole, threw them in, and covered them up. So whatever was going on, there were a lot of these little idols, a lot of these little images. the worship of both the female form and of the concept that there's more to God than the God that we see within our Old Testament. There was more to that than that to worship in those days is certainly very prevalent at the time when we come to look at what Ezekiel had to say. Now, we've already mentioned that Ezekiel was a prisoner in Babylon, and the first thing that we see in Ezekiel is the assurance that God is with him regardless of his circumstance. And we also mention that Ezekiel had a very unpopular message to deliver. One of the first things that Ezekiel had to say to these people is the start of chapter 4. he was instructed to take a tile, a little flat surface. Tile is the word that is in my translation. And put it out in front of people. And portray on it the city. In our showcase, we have a little model of the temple at the time of Herod. So for Ezekiel then, up in this corner, there would have been the temple. The city of David would go down that direction, and the new city, as it had extended during the time of the later kings, would come out towards you in that way. So that the city itself was not really square, but somewhat that way, with the temple up in this top corner here. So it would be really simple to make an image that people could relate to. There would be no question that what Ezekiel had put in front of these people who came to see him in his little model was indeed the city. And then as we work our way down through the first half dozen verses in this chapter 4, we see that Ezekiel laid a siege engine around it. And so the message was quite clear. There was no question in their minds that they were talking about Jerusalem. But just think for a moment what their circumstance was. They had been through that. They had been captured. They had been taken to Babylon because Jehoiakim had rebelled against the king of Babylon, and the Babylonian army had come back into the area and made certain that they were properly pacified. They had taken away the leaders in the community, those who could mount some sort of effective resistance, could organize a resistance. They had taken away the priests, because frequently priests were a center of cultural feelings and ideas of independence can grow from that source. They had taken away artisans, and we mentioned last time that there is within the Babylonian tablets, within the Babylonian chronicles, the rations that were given to Jehoiachin. And so we are assured that Jehoiachin was there in Babylon when Ezekiel said he was there, and we are told that the Babylonian kings made allowance for their living at that time. We also have a man called Shemaliah, who we are told was a gardener, and his rations are also there, and that gives you some idea of what was going on in Babylon, because they took away people that were useful. And certainly within the confines of the modern city of Babylon, there were wonderful plantings surrounding the palace at any rate, and out into the surrounding areas. Gardeners were important. They took the people that could be fitted into the Babylonian economy and made use of them in Babylon. And many of them, we have the names for these people recorded within the Babylonian chronicles. That had happened. Zedekiah was now in Babylon. And as long as Zedekiah continued to pay his taxes, there was no need to assume that things would go wrong back in Jerusalem. And there were many who apparently concluded just that way. There were many who apparently felt that there was nothing that could go wrong anymore. We were all here in Babylon. We weren't going to make any trouble, Ezekiel and his companions, as long as the Zedekiah and his people continued to pay their taxes. There was nothing to worry about. We'll come to this point a little later. It was definitely there among the people who came to see Jeremiah, who came to see Ezekiel. So why the little model? Because God had said, it's going to happen. And we can begin to see that there was this sense of disbelief among those who came to Ezekiel. But he was a recognized prophet. He had seen visions, and he had imparted those visions to them. And so there was no reason for them not to go to see what he would say. They didn't believe what he was saying. When you start then in the ninth verse, Ezekiel is told to take a certain amount of foodstuffs. And then he had to make this last, because the siege was going to last for a long time. And towards the end of this period, when he was making cakes out of this small amount of food material that he had, these few grains that he had, we're told that he had to use dung as one of the components in the mixture to make cakes. That was a very graphic indication of how severe a famine was going to be. A little model. You've seen the city. It's going to be besieged. The siege is going to be very long. And then when we get into the beginning of the next chapter, Ezekiel is told to cut his hair. Cut it and separate the hair into three pieces. And the three pieces were treated in different ways. And when we get to the end of the fifth chapter, we see that these three portions of his hair, the one was indicative of the many people who would die as the result of the Babylonian army coming back into the land of Judah. The next point were those who would be killed directly in the armed intervention of the Babylonians. The third part of his hair indicated that they would be scattered. His hair was distributed. And they were. Jeremiah, and I apologize for using that term inaccurately a few minutes ago, Jeremiah found his way into Egypt along with people. Some of them went as far as Egypt. Others went into Babylon. Others simply disappeared into the hills to get away from the Babylonian army. And a few remained in Judea to maintain as best they could the land that was their father's. That was the message. That was the message that Jeremiah had to give. It was an unpopular message. It was hard to accept. It was very difficult for Jeremiah to, for Ezekiel to stand in front of people and to keep having to deliver this. Why? What made it so difficult? We find that in the 13th chapter of Ezekiel. The word of the Lord came unto me saying, Son of man, prophesy against the prophets of Israel that prophesy, and say thou unto them that prophesy out of their own hearts. That prophesy out of their own hearts. What does that mean? Surely it means that here I'm letting out my emotions, my feelings, what I think, what's important to me. What was important to me in that day? What was important? 10th verse. Because they have seduced my people, saying peace. Saying peace. And there was no peace. I picked this little book up in the British Museum on our last trip there. It has a number of items in it which are relative to the Bible. This one that I'm going to quote a little bit from at the moment is on what I was called one of the Lachish letters. It's an ostracon from Lachish. At the time when this was written, Zedekiah had been besieged in Jerusalem for a number of years. There were only two other towns in Judea that were still in Jewish hands at that time, Azekah and Lachish. And both of them were destroyed by Nebuchadnezzar shortly thereafter. And we remember that on this occasion that Nebuchadnezzar destroyed Jerusalem, and then he set up a small regional capital just north of Jerusalem and put Gedaliah in place as the governor when Zedekiah was taken out of Jerusalem. Now, at a time then when everything was going wrong, when there was really no way out, and surely they must have seen this, somebody wrote to the military commander in Lachish, "May Yahweh cause my Lord to hear news of peace, even now. Even now. May Yahweh cause my Lord to hear news of peace, even now." When it was obvious, if it was ever obvious, that peace was completely out of the question, when it was only a matter of time when the last few pockets of resistance would be stamped out in Judea. You see that thought. It's interesting that you find it. You find it even in little bits of stone with Hebrew scribbled on them. You find it coming from this period. Likewise, thou son of man, set thy face against the daughters of the people which prophesy out of their own heart. The prophets of Israel which prophesy concerning Jerusalem and which see visions of peace for her. There is no peace, saith the Lord God. There is no peace. And in the 14th chapter, son of man, these men have set up their idols in their heart and put the stumbling block of their iniquity before their face, that I may take the house of Israel in their own heart because they are estranged. This is the 5th verse for me, because of their idols. And therefore, say unto the house of Israel, repent and turn yourselves from your idols and turn away your faces from your abominations. Turn away your faces from your abominations. And the word which, as we have said, that Ezekiel uses for idols speaks of a situation where he's really referring to them as items of excrement. So what's the role of the prophet? Let's turn to that point now. We're going to go shortly into the 20th chapter of Ezekiel, but as we go there, let's just sort of talk for a minute about what's going on. And let's just stop and think for a few minutes about what it means, what it meant to be Hebrew in this day and age. What does it mean, thou shalt have none other gods beside me? What does the phrase mean in Deuteronomy? Hear, O Israel, the Lord thy God is one Lord. What does it mean? Does it mean that indeed there is one discrete God? I think everyone in this room would argue that that's exactly what it means. But just think for a minute. If there is only one God, Where did all the others come from? What place had all the other things that were going on? As we said, if you were journeying with a group of traders into Palestine, you would stop for the night and make sure that you had safe passage into the surrounding area of Judea. And there you could make an offering to Yahweh if you wanted. You would find your own God from back home here and so forth. They were all there. And as we indicated to you, there were all kinds of other gods, particularly female forms of God beside Yahweh. And we'll see in a few minutes that they were even there in the temple. That was in that 8th chapter which was read to you. They were there also. You see, the Mosaic Covenant, let's call it that, the Mosaic Covenant was being violated very severely at that point, at its most fundamental starting point. Hear, O Israel, the Lord your God is one Lord. But there's every indication that there were many, many, many Judeans who accepted all of the other gods that were around them. Monotheism to them didn't necessarily mean only Yahweh. What about the commandment dealing with graven images? That wasn't there either. And we notice this, and we can see quite clearly that that indeed was the function of a prophet, to point out to them that they as a nation should have accepted the fact that there was only one God and held to that, and ignored the multiculturalism which we pride our society on nowadays. There's that interesting little situation again in Kings where Ahab was in Syria and he saw that form of an altar and decided that he would like one of those and copied it back home. Nowadays, that's a great and a wonderful thing. It's a cultural exchange. It's something that we pride ourselves on. You see, the more things change, the more they stay the same. That idea, these cultural exchanges were there in the time of Ahab. They were going on in the time of Ezekiel. The more things change, the more they stay the same. There was another side to this. There was not just the religious side of things. There was also the social side of things. For Moses gave them a complete way of life, gave them a form of religion, and it also gave them a way of life. And that was also one of the things which was being discarded and which Ezekiel had to bring to their attention and say you had to get back to the basic principles on which our society should be built. And what were those things and how had they strayed from them? Ezekiel 20 now. We're going to look at verse 10 and work on from there a little bit. Wherefore, and now we're coming back very much to the time of Moses. We're coming back to the time of when the nation, their set of practices, religious practices, legal practices, and everything else were first formulated. We're coming back to that. And Ezekiel is appealing back to that point. Wherefore I caused them to go forth out of the land of Egypt and brought them into the wilderness, said God through Ezekiel. And I gave them my statutes and my judgments. Two things, statutes and judgments. And we can see both legal concepts and the other concepts, the values which they had in their society and which the principles upon which they should live their lives. Which if a man do, he shall live in them. Moreover, I also gave them my Sabbath to be a sign between me and them that they might know that I am the Lord that sanctify them. And so they had a way of life which was everything from their regular religious practices, that regular reminders of the fact that God had delivered them, had formed them as a nation, had given them a land. All of these reminders were there and had given them a way of life and had given them a set of laws. And if they thought about it often enough and hard enough, they would realize that they had been told that those laws would be the envy of all the nations round about if they actually followed them. But they seemed to have considered the way that other people did things to be more important. Not just more important, and we know that there were many alliances made by the kings to cement. Solomon was one of the best at it. To cement their standing in the Middle Eastern community. Ideas were brought in, ways of doing things were brought in, and it diluted their central point to their lives. Look at verse 15. Now, it's quite true that what we're talking about here is the fact that they didn't get into the land. But we're going to pick up this one little phrase there, with a land flowing with milk and honey, and consider what that means. Now, as we indicated to you, what God is saying, because of what you did in the past, you didn't get into the land on the first try through Moses. You had to go back and do it again later. But they were promised a land flowing with milk and honey. You see, what God was offering to them was a place where they could build a home, an area where there was rain, often enough and regular enough that they could grow crops. A land which was varied enough topographically that they could grow everything. And at the time of the Assyrians, the olive harvest in Judea was prized. A land where they could grow. And nowadays, if you go there, you can get nuts and almonds. You can get apricots, all kinds of things there. The fruits from this area are really outstanding. There were minerals there. There was passage, there was pasture there. And there were highways, there were valleys that you could build roads through. There were ways that you could get back and forth and you could trade within those areas. It was a land which fulfilled all of their physical requirements in that it flowed with milk and with honey. God also gave them a way of life, a set of laws, and a set of religious principles. But look at Ezekiel 22. It's not the first time that these ideas are present in the prophets. Ezekiel 22, verse 7. And we're talking about Jerusalem here, in the city of Jerusalem, have they set light by father and mother. In the midst of thee they have dealt by oppression with the stranger. In thee they have vexed the fatherless and the widows. And in Moses, this term, fatherless and widows, is the basis for the social programs which were generated within the law of Moses. The idea that the whole of society should be there for all of its members, whatever their circumstance, that nobody should, as we say nowadays, fall between the cracks. And they had let these things go. As a nation, they had let them go. 11th verse. And one hath committed abomination with his neighbor's wife, and another hath lewdly deviled his daughter-in-law. There's nothing unusual about things like that in our society. And there was nothing unusual about it within Jewish society. But you see, they had let go their social responsibilities, and they had let loose a set of values which they should never, never have espoused. 24th verse. Son of man, say unto her, thou art the land that is not cleansed nor rained upon in the day of indignation. There is a conspiracy of her prophets in the midst thereof, like a roaring lion ravening the prey. They have devoured souls. They have taken the treasure and precious things. They have made her many widows in the midst thereof. Her priests have violated my law, have profaned mine holy places. They have put no difference between the holy and profane, neither have they showed difference between the unclean and the clean. They have hid their eyes from my Sabbaths, and I am profaned amongst them. Her princes in the midst thereof are like wolves ravening the prey to shed blood and to destroy souls and to get. And there's a modern phrase. It's an interesting little phrase. We have a former prime minister who has refused to go back and speak to a parliamentary committee. Why? Because there's $300,000 kicking around somewhere which nobody can quite trace, and nobody can quite figure out what it was paid for, and nobody can quite decide where it came from. But everybody agrees that there's about $300,000 which moved from somewhere to somewhere else. So what's this little phrase here? More things change, more they stay the same. Ezekiel was facing the same problems that we have in our society. They shed blood and to destroy souls to get dishonest gain. To get dishonest gain. And her prophets have daubed them with untempered mortar. And on it goes. The social issues had been discarded, along with the very fundamental aspects of Jewish religion. The most basic of Jewish ideas. Hear, O Israel, the Lord your God is one Lord. And they in their day had dozens of gods. And more particularly, they had both male and female gods, and they had effectively discarded then the very form of God which had been presented to them from the beginnings. From the beginnings of their word. As we said, it's really interesting. You can start out in Genesis and you can ask a very simple question. What does it mean to be made in the image of God? And you can end up with a very unusual set of answers if you let your mind flow along the particular direction. Those directions were apparent in Ezekiel's day. They're apparent in our day. I want to go now to the chapter which was read to you, the 8th chapter of Ezekiel, and to look at what was going on in the temple. We have seen that the message which Ezekiel gave was very necessary. The whole countryside was full of a myriad of forms of worship. The worship of God had been terribly misapplied. The values of the way of life that had been given to these people under Moses had been discarded for personal advantage. And now we go back. And remember that we are seeing this from a distance. We're seeing this not actually by being there. But we're seeing this through the eyes of one who is in Babylon as a prisoner. We're seeing this as a vision. So what we're seeing is maybe not precisely what is going on, but it's a real indication of the way their community was being built. Came to pass in the 6th year, and this is the way the prophecies of Ezekiel are dated. They deal with the captivity of Jehoiachin. That Ezekiel was once again sitting in his house, and the elders of Judah came, and this was a regular thing. There are several occasions where they come to inquire what Ezekiel would have to say. And Ezekiel, it says, the hand of the Lord fell upon him and he saw a vision, brightness and light. And those were hallmarks of the vision that he had seen in the first and third chapters. And he put forth the form of a hand and took me and the visions of God to Jerusalem, to the door of the inner gate that looked toward the north. So this is territory that Ezekiel knew very well. And it could be described to those who came to see him, for they too would know the structure of the temple, would know which gates were being referred to and so forth. And we have something called an image of jealousy, which is there, but the glory of God was there, according to the vision that I saw in the plain. But the glory of God was there. So in the temple, we have this thing which is referred to as an image of jealousy at this point. And we also have the glory of God taking Ezekiel back to see what is going on in the land when Zedekiah was king. Zedekiah was king for 11 years. Then he said unto me, Son of man, lift your eyes now to the north. So I lifted my eyes to the north, and there was this image of jealousy. And then he said, can you see what's going on there? Even the great abominations, we're now in the sixth verse, that the house of Israel committed, that I should go far off from my sanctuary. This is an indication of what's happening, that God should go far off from his sanctuary. Why? Because of what was happening there in the temple at that time. He brought me to the door of the court, and behold, a hole in the wall. And this, as I say, was picked up by one or two people when Kathleen Kenyon found right up against the temple and sort of excavated partly into the wall of the temple this cache with some at least 350 little naked female figurines. And from all the other places and figurines that have been found, it's obvious that they were religious figurines, images of Asherah, as we know her nowadays, this female goddess of the Canaanites. He brought me to the door, behold a hole, and the son of man dig there. Behold the abominations that they do. So I went in and saw all the idols of the house of Israel portrayed on the wall round about. 70 men, and in the midst of them stood Jezaniah, the son of Shaphan, with every man his censer in his hand. It doesn't necessarily mean that Jezaniah was Shaphan's son, or that, let's put it the other way, that Shaphan was Jezaniah's father. What it does mean was that Jezaniah was a descendant. It definitely means this. Just how far back it went is another question. So which Shaphan we're talking about is a bit of a question. But you can find that word, you can find that name in Kings. You can find Shaphan mentioned in Kings and mentioned honorably in Kings. So we have more than likely a descendant of someone who had an honorable function in the service of God, now present in the middle of what was going on in a very idolatrous series of worship acts. They had their censers, burning incense. And it's interesting that among and many of these things were found as within sort of family confines. It's interesting when you look at the archaeology of the period just leading up to this. The Israelites had started out really as an agrarian nation. They had started out really as a farming community. They had been given their land, and they had portions of it, and they farmed it, and they provided for their family upkeep, and they provided for the upkeep and the sustenance of those who served in the temple on the basis of the agricultural base land, way of life that they had on their land base. We have then sort of estates, country estates, as it were, evidenced all through the later periods of the kings throughout the land of Judea. And in many of these, we also have little shrines. And in those shrines, there are incense altars and libation vessels, and in many cases, female goddesses, as well as probable little places where people would go to remember that Yahweh was indeed their God. So we're looking at something which was more widespread, but which was also present and very much present within the confines of the temple. And remember that when we use the word idols in Ezekiel, we're actually talking about pieces of excrement. In Ezekiel's eyes, that's what these idols were. And so he uses a term to describe them, which had that root meaning within the Hebrew language. And they said unto me, Son of man, hast thou not seen what the ancients, in the 12th verse, every man in the chambers of his imagery? For they say, the Lord seeth us not. The Lord hath forsaken the earth. It seems to have got to that point within the thinking of those who stayed behind with Zedekiah. They felt abandoned. Why should they feel abandoned? What they had been doing, they were quite convinced was right. We're told that the prophets spoke from their hearts. They spoke from what was inside them, from their innermost feelings. And their innermost feelings were that we could achieve peace in this land. They had said that. And Ezekiel had said, no, you guys have mistook it. They thought they were doing the right thing, but they were actually running society for their own personal gain. And we have ample evidence of that in the time of Jesus by the priesthood that was in Jerusalem. They ran the temple for personal profit. It seems that the same thing was going on here in Ezekiel's day. And whom was Tammuz, which is there in the 14th verse? Well, in a lot of Bible dictionaries, they refer to this as Adonis, and that goes back to the time of Jerome, which is the 3rd century AD and the start of the Vulgate translation. But it's obviously not that, because that was a Greek god, and this is much before that. Nowadays, it's more than certain that Tammuz is here as a Mesopotamian deity. So, you see, along with the Babylonian and Assyrian invaders had come gods. And those gods were accepted by people who were associated with the temple. Hear, O Israel, the Lord your God is one Lord. And there was an Assyrian god with them at that time. He brought me into the inner court, and we talked about this last time. Men that were looking toward the east, toward the rising sun, in the end of the 16th verse, and to worship toward the rising sun, they had turned their back on the sanctuary of God. So within the temple itself, there were idols. Within the temple itself, there were people who burnt incense to foreign gods. Within the temple itself, there were reminders of the gods that had invaded their land. Within the temple itself, there were those who didn't look toward the sanctuary where God was, but toward the rising sun, which was another form of worship within the Middle East. There's a word violence in the 17th chapter, 17th verse. Toward the end of that verse, there's the word violence. When we read that word, we almost always think of violence. We think of people being hit, pushed around, killed even. And certainly there's a situation in Judges where that word violence refers to violence, where several people were murdered. But if you look at all the other places where the word violence is used, and remember that in the 20th chapter we had seen that the priests violated the law, what we're really talking about here is not physical violence. It's a severe misuse of the commands of God. And if you follow the way the word is used and the places which it is presented to us throughout the Old Testament, beginning with that famous place in the time of Noah, the earth was filled with violence. It's obvious from the basis, from the massive information, that what we've got here is a situation of people violating the law of God, of people ignoring, pushing it to one side, not paying any attention to the law of God. Violence isn't necessarily violence, but it may lead to it. It was rather a removal of oneself from the law of God. These people didn't hear the prophets, and so what was the result? Well, we've just looked at the beginning of the 8th chapter, and we've seen that God was there in the temple, showing Ezekiel around. But if you turn over to the next chapter, the 9th chapter, the 3rd verse, and the glory of the Lord of Israel was gone up from the cherub whereupon he was to the threshold of the house. So the glory of God would normally be in the holy place. Would normally be where you actually couldn't see it. And it was now out where, if you knew it was there, where you would be able to see it, because it had come out into the open and was above the threshold of the house. Why was it moving? Was moving because of what was taking place in that 8th chapter. It was moving because of what was going on in the house of the Lord. 10th chapter, 4th verse, and the glory of the Lord went up from the cherub and stood over the threshold of the house, and the house was filled with a cloud, and the court was full of the brightness of the Lord. It's there still. It's there still, claiming this space for Yahweh. 18th verse. And the glory of the Lord departed from off the threshold of the house, stood over the cherubims, was moving. It's almost as if, as we may say nowadays, should I or shouldn't I? Is it worth staying? Or do I have to leave? Can I not stand it here anymore? Those are very human, very anthropomorphic ways of stating the case. But that seems to be what's going on. Should God actually leave his house? The cherubs lifted up their wings, mounted up from the earth in my sight when I went out, and the wheels were also with beside them, and everyone stood at the door of the east gate of the Lord's house. This is going out. This is the way out. The glory of the Lord of Israel was over above them. And then when you turn over, you find that it went and it stood on a mountain and looked down, and then it left. They had turned their back on God. They had brought all kinds of different forms of worship into their society. This is there, it's there, we know what was going on from, and there are two or three things I could have quoted from little books like this. We know what is going on in that land from the archaeological record. We have a literary record of what was going on at this same time. So we know that what Ezekiel was saying was based on fact. But nevertheless, in the 16th chapter, in the 60th verse, we have these words. Nevertheless, I will remember my covenant with thee in the days of thy youth, and I will establish unto thee an everlasting covenant. Thou shalt remember my ways and be ashamed. And I will establish in the 62nd verse my covenant with thee, and thou shalt know that I am the Lord, that thou mayest remember and be confounded, that you may remember. That was the thing that they didn't do. That was their problem. They hadn't remembered. And they had decided on taking in all kinds of other things. Next time we're going to start in the 17th chapter. This is an interesting little chapter because it's a vision of what was going on historically at the time, because the nation was flopping back and forth between the Egyptians. They thought the Egyptians might help them, but they couldn't. They thought, well, better make a deal with the Babylonians, as they did in the time of Zedekiah. That didn't work out. And then Gedaliah was murdered, and after that, the nation was no more for several years. So we're going to start in the 17th chapter and look at that, and then extend this into the day that we see nowadays, because these words may have meaning for us. At the end of that chapter, we're obviously looking at references to Jesus, and we're obviously seeing that there was more to what Ezekiel was saying than merely a reference to the people that he served in his day.